ever spent time looking at sensitive court records or sensitive public records of any kind, you've probably seen black bars over text that's designed to keep information secret. Well, Kentucky Public Radio figured out a way to see what's under those black bars in the Kentucky Attorney General's lawsuit against TikTok. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our Friday News Review, we're going to hear about the lawsuit and the information that was supposed to stay hidden. We'll also hear about Cincinnati's newest city council member and Cincinnati Public Schools' next phase to reorganize some schools in the district. Joining me now to talk about this lawsuit against TikTok are Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman. Welcome back, Sylvia.
Glad to be here.
And Kentucky Lantern health and policy reporter Sarah Ladd. Thanks for being here, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
Sylvia, more than a dozen attorneys general, including Kentucky's, are suing TikTok, saying it's harmful for children. What's the basis of this lawsuit? What are they alleging?
So they're alleging that TikTok addicted young children, so children under, 18, and that not only did they addict those children to their platform, that they also knew that it was harmful to them and that they did not appropriately moderate that content. They didn't protect children on the platform and that they knew that their safety measures were ineffective.
And Sylvia, I kind of alluded to this. Many of the documents in this lawsuit were redacted, essentially blacked out to keep information secret. But you could read some of the text anyway. Talk to us about that and what those parts of this lawsuit said.
You know, I really, really wish I could say I used some like fancy software to make that happen. That's someone else asked me, what technique did you use? I used copy and paste. So essentially, it was just ineffectively redacted and the text underneath was still intact. And I could just copy and paste that text into a new document and read everything that said. It basically revealed the results of what I believe to be a 2-year investigation by these attorneys general into TikTok internal communications and documents. So what's blacked out is the AG's summary and quotes from those documents. We don't have them directly. We know how the Attorney General has interpreted them and specific quotes that they quote several employees and executives at TikTok in how they also viewed some of their own safety measures. And basically what it showed, I mean, if the Attorney General has faithfully interpreted these documents, it shows that TikTok was aware that many of their safety measures and guardrails were not effective in protecting children from harmful content, that many of these tools that they've rolled out in recent years to prove that they're trying to limit screen time among minors, they knew to be ineffective. For example, teens might see a limit pop up after they've been scrolling for an hour. They did internal testing that had a minute difference on the amount of time that children spent on the platform. In an internal test, it went from 108.5 minutes to 107. So, I mean, a very insignificant difference in internal experiments on their own limits.
And why would this information have been redacted, Sylvia?
That's a great question. And we kind of got a little bit of a peek into why from a court document that the Attorney General filed after my initial reporting on this redacted information. He moved that the court seal the document moving forward. He hadn't previously done that. And in that document, asking the court to seal it, he mentions that they signed some sort of confidentiality agreement with TikTok to facilitate the sharing of information. It was potentially over the possibility of sharing trade secrets, things like that. We decided to move forward and publish additional details from that document after the court sealed it.
Sarah, is this lawsuit alleging the company broke a state law in Kentucky?
It's alleging, as Sylvia mentioned earlier, that yes, it's basically saying they're deliberately and knowingly harming youth and failing to warn about danger. So you see a lot of this pushback against this failure to warn part. Just in September, Attorney General Russell Coleman was one of, I believe, 42 attorneys general who asked for a Surgeon General warning on social media saying, hey, this could cause damage. just like you see on a bottle of alcohol, if you buy it, it'll say consumption of alcoholic beverages, you know, impairs your ability to drive or operate machinery, could cause health problems. And so we know, like it or hate it, we know there is research that says the more time you spend on social media, you can have an increased risk of anxiety, depression, stress, things like that. We see really bad statistics around that, especially for teenage girls who are engaged in these sorts of platforms. So yes, they're saying, among other things, that TikTok failed to warn about the damages.
And Sarah, how has TikTok responded to these lawsuits?
Yeah, so TikTok put out a statement basically saying that they strongly disagreed with the claims that they were designed to addict children. And they said the claims they found, or some of the claims they found, to be misleading and inaccurate. And it did say, you know, throughout this 2-year process of the investigation, that they believe they cooperated with attorneys general and were just disappointed by the action that these states took.
Sylvia, you mentioned, and then Sarah also mentioned, this 2-year time frame that I guess these attorneys general have been working with the company or investigating the company. What do you have any other insights into what the expectation was? I mean, was TikTok thinking if they gave this information, there wouldn't be a lawsuit, or what? Is there any additional light you can shine on that?
I really couldn't say what TikTok was hoping to come out of this, if not a litigation. You know, I guess one of the big, also, obviously, TikTok has not just been talked about on the state level. We've heard plenty about it from the federal level. You know, TikTok is currently fighting a law that is set to go in effect in January that would ban TikTok nationwide if it wasn't sold to a U.S. distributor. Is distributor the right word? Parent company, something like that. And essentially, what this attorney general, I think a notable part of this is that they're all filed in state court. These are not combined lawsuits, so they'll each work their way through state court somewhat independently. And they're all based on individual states' consumer protection laws. So we could see really different outcomes depending on different states. And it's really kind of a wait and see game. But again, I don't know exactly what TikTok was expecting. But like Sarah was mentioning, they seem to imply from their statement, they felt like they were being cooperating with the attorneys general and weren't expecting, or at least were hoping, that it wouldn't result in litigation of this level, at least.
Sarah, you were talking about some of the studies that have brought up health concerns about the use of social media. You also talked to some child advocates about this lawsuit and you know, what their concerns are. What did you hear from them?
Sure. Well, first, you know, Forbes has reported, and there have been other studies basically comparing TikTok use and social media use in general to, you know, just kind of a dopamine release spiral, and kind of comparing it to taking drugs. And so the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which really fights for policy that improves the welfare of children nationwide, you know, kind of backs that up and says that companies have a responsibility to better monitor children and minors' use of social media and to really prioritize their health, especially because a lot of these children we're talking about are very young. Maybe they don't yet have the ability to self-monitor. So they're saying companies have a right, or a responsibility rather, to do that for them. And Kentucky Youth Advocates, which is kind of part of the Annie E. Casey Foundation, they gave a really big thumbs up to the lawsuit, basically saying that it's a way of standing up for Kentucky's young people and Kentucky's children. Terry Brooks, who leads the Kentucky Youth Advocates, talked about TikTok being addictive and exposing children to exploitation, unsafe situations, unrealistic standards, whether that's body standards or other standards, and even sexually explicit content. So they are giving it a thumbs up for pushing back against that.
Sylvia, what's this lawsuit seeking from TikTok? Is that clear?
Yeah, essentially, since it's based on consumer protection laws, they're asking for, I believe it's $2,000. I need to double check that, for each count, for each violation of Kentucky's consumer protection laws. And it's also asking the court to strip TikTok of all its profits that it's reaped from violations against minors in the state. Whatever that number is, it's sure to be a high one based on like what the Kentucky Attorney General has alleged. And I'm also, you know, it could be a very variable number depending on each of the different states involved here.
Yeah. And with all these different states, you know, Sarah, we've talked about how all the different states are pursuing this action based on their own state laws. We've talked about how there are all these other things in the works to try to, the federal legislation, all these things in the works to try to kind of get a handle on TikTok and prevent any alleged harm against children. How do you have any sense, Sarah, how effective those other efforts have been? I mean, you know, we talked about this law that I guess takes effect in January. How have these efforts to kind of go after social media companies for the way they affect children, how have those efforts gone?
I'm not aware of any resolutions as of yet, but, you know, the Surgeon General warning I mentioned from September is very recent. This, of course, just happened. And what we do know is these things take a really long time. So I'm not aware of any outcomes yet, but it will be interesting to see and to follow how that turns out in the different states and in Kentucky, of course.
Sylvia, you mentioned that these documents have been, so this court case has been that the Attorney General's asked for it to be sealed now at this point to protect this agreement, apparently. What's next with this? When will we know kind of next steps with this whole case?
Ooh, your guess is as good as mine. I'm not sure. You know, it's also worth looking at other states, too. I believe in D.C., that attorney general is actually suing to reveal elements of their own lawsuit. Those details could become public. We'll see if they match up directly with Kentucky's. And so each attorney general is going to take a different tact in this. I'm not sure when we'll have our next update in Kentucky. Like Sarah was saying, it can take a really long time here. I mean, there are just some pretty wild, like interesting allegations in this lawsuit that we haven't talked about yet. Like, you know, what Sarah was talking about when we talk about beauty standards and its effect on young girls. You know, there's some allegations that TikTok specifically changed their algorithm to lower the priority of less attractive people on their platform. I mean, there's just a lot to work through in this case and a lot of allegations made. I would expect it to take a really long time in the courts to work out.
Well, I have been talking with Kentucky Public Radio Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman and Kentucky Lantern health and policy reporter Sarah Ladd. Thank you both so much for your time today and for your work on this important issue.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Up next, we'll hear about the newest member of Cincinnati City Council. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati City Council has a new council member to finish the term of former council member Reggie Harris. Here to tell us about Evan Nolan is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome back, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy.
Tell us about Evan Nolan. I understand he was chosen to serve the remainder of former council member Reggie Harris's term.
That's right. So he is an attorney, has been in private practice law for most of his career, but he did spend several months working in the city law department until that was in 2022. And in late 2022, he actually resigned from that position because he had put his name forward to replace now Congressman Greg Landsman, who was leaving council at that time there was a vacancy and a similar process played out. Did not end up getting named for that position. That Reggie Harris ended up choosing Seth Walsh to replace Landsman. So he went back to private practice, but now here he is again, headed to City Hall as the next council member.
And I understand council member Mika Owens was in charge of this process, picking Reggie Harris's replacement.
That's right.
How did she explain this pick?
Yeah, so she said one of the biggest things that she was looking for was someone who was ready on day one and someone who had the same priorities as the current council. So, you know, we've talked before about how all nine council members are Democrats. That's the first time that's happened in a very, very long time. Evan Nolan, of course, is also a Democrat. But this council has tried to present itself as very united on the issues, despite some disagreements here and there. And so we're certainly looking to, they were certainly looking to preserve that sort of unity moving forward. But also Harris Owens. Owens described Nolan as empathetic, as an intelligent leader. She relied on an advisory panel who helped her interview the final six candidates that she had narrowed the list down to, and said, you know, that she relied on their advice and didn't want to just make the decision alone. So she said she's looking forward to working with Nolan in the days to come.
You mentioned that there were six finalists. Was there a lot of interest in this position?
There was, unsurprisingly. So unlike when Harris ran the process to replace Landsman on council, he did it as sort of an application process and had folks formally apply and then announced a sort of short list shortly after that. Instead, Harris invited folks to...
This would be Mika Owens invited.
Mika Owens.
That's okay.
Gosh,
why do I
keep doing that?
Yeah.
Owens invited folks to reach out to her office if they were interested. 27 people did. Now, the six names of the folks that she interviewed are not on that list. So there were an unknown number of other candidates that she considered. But yeah, certainly a lot of folks interested in taking this position.
Do we know where those six names came from if they weren't on the list?
I do not know officially.
Okay.
You know, it's the kind of thing where it would have been nice to ask that question at the press conference this morning, but no questions were allowed by press at that press conference. So I do have an interview scheduled with Mika Owens and Evan Nolan and hope to find out a little bit more information about that process.
Okay. Reggie Harris had some pretty specific ideas about the qualities he wanted to see in whoever replaced him on council. How does Evan Nolan kind of match up with those ideas, those qualities?
Yeah, so when we talked to former Councilmember Harris about what he wanted to see in this position, he had sort of three ideas. Two were demographic. One, he pointed out that he was one of only two African-American men on council, Scotty Johnson being the other African-American man. The other being that Harris was the only member of the LGBTQ community part of council. Now, he wasn't the first. Obviously, Chris Seelbach was on council for a long time before him. And so he mentioned those as two things, not necessarily the most important, but things to keep in mind in terms of representation on council. But the third, you know, he seemed to prioritize a bit more is similar to what Mika Owens said, which is a commitment to growing the city and a commitment to council's priorities on that. Now, interestingly, this is an area where council is not super united and where it makes sense that an additional vote might be crucial in future projects. Of course, the connected community zoning reform has already passed, and so that's the biggest hurdle that, you know, this council has faced so far, and it was not a unanimous vote. You know, there was not agreement on council on how to equitably grow the city. So I think that sort of perspective on pro-development, pro-housing, you know, growing the city, although all members of council, I think, would say that they are in favor of growth, they would certainly not agree on the best or most equitable way to accomplish that. So I think that would be some of the key things that Owens was looking for in this appointment.
And in that way, Evan Nolan kind of matches up.
Apparently, again, have not had a chance to ask any questions yet.
Yeah,
so, you know, that's the kind of thing we're looking forward to learning more about.
Yeah. This seat opened up because Reggie Harris left council for a job with the Biden administration. How long is the rest of this term?
It runs through the end of 2025. All nine council seats are on the same schedule, and they are two-year terms. So this will be the second year of Harris's two-year term. And that means all nine council seats are going to be up for election next year. So Nolan won't be the only one running, but he is likely to run to, you know, win a full term on that dais.
Hmm. And we've talked about this a little bit more, and this might be an almost impossible question to answer since they did not take questions this morning. But do you have any sense for what this new council member's other priorities might be on council?
Yeah, you know, he did speak for a few minutes and talked about the what he sees as sharing council's priorities. And it's a lot of topics that we've heard about a lot. The things that, you know, probably anyone would say are some of the top priorities. So what he listed would be public safety, balancing the budget, which the city does have a balanced budget currently, but with the benefit of lots of federal stimulus, economic development, affordable housing, reducing gun violence, pedestrian safety, and climate change. Climate change is an interesting one, a key one there. You know, I wouldn't say it's not a priority of council, but it doesn't come up as often as some of these other topics. However, important to note that Mika Owens is currently chair of the Climate, Environment, and Infrastructure Committee. So obviously a priority of hers and something that she seems to have been looking for as well in this appointment.
Okay. Well, one of the many decisions that this new council member will get to help make is how to spend some city money. And there's a lot left over from the city's last budget. Tell us about this $65 million.
Yeah. So one thing to keep in mind is this happens every year. It's not totally unexpected. This is a bit higher of a carryover budget than is maybe typical for the city. But the city budget officials certainly overestimate how much they expect to spend in a year and underestimate how much revenue is expected to come in. It's a conservative approach to that. It means that there's not a deficit at the end of the year. So that's something that, you know, we see every year is what we call the carryover budget, which is everything that's left over then gets allocated in different ways. So $65 million total. Quite a bit of that ends up going into several reserve accounts. So this is basically the city savings for a rainy day. There are several different versions of these accounts for different purposes. And the city aims to save at least 16.7% of the previous year's revenue. And the city did hit that again this year. They're at 17% of the previous year revenue. And so that, you know, exceeds the expectation that the city has. That's a recommendation, by the way, from the Government Finance Officers Association. So it's not a legal requirement, but it's just an expectation. And that number does sort of heavily influence the city's bond rating, which determines how much money the city can borrow for projects and things like that. So certainly significant.
Mm-hmm. And how expensive that money is to borrow, too, right? The bond rating.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Council already decided how to spend a big chunk of that money. You talked about kind of these different savings accounts. Walk us through where that money is going, some of these big kind of line items.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, the sort of savings accounts, the other two big things, this is something that kind of happens automatically because of council policy that they passed several years ago. There is also $5 million headed to the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, and $2 million is headed into the city's long-troubled retirement system. There's an unfunded liability there. We've talked about it on this program. Now, this is in addition to the sort of percentage of salaries that the city puts into the retirement fund every year, so it's basically just an extra one-time end-of-year payment. The city also, or council, excuse me, approved some one-time spending. So this is money that was recommended by the city manager and the mayor in sort of two separate buckets of projects that, you know, needed some extra funding. Some of that is just as simple as it was allocated in last year's budget, but was not allocated or the contract wasn't signed by the end of the fiscal year. So it just kind of carries over into the next fiscal year. Excuse me. Other sort of big ticket items here you'll see are wage increases for the fire department and the police department, as well as retroactive pay and some one-time lump sum payments. These are here because after the city finalized the fiscal year budget in June, the city finally finalized the bargaining agreements with those two departments. And so that happened and the determination of wages was finalized after the budget was passed.
And the budget that they passed didn't have quite enough money in it to meet those agreements.
Exactly. They had planned for a wage increase, but not one that was at the level that was agreed upon in the bargaining agreement. So it'll cover just the difference between those two for the next fiscal year.
One of the mayor's proposals related to what the city does with firearms that the police no longer use. I thought that was really interesting. Walk us through that.
Yeah, this was a program I wasn't aware existed until this. It was really interesting to see the change here. So basically, before this change, the city purchases all officer firearms from Smith & Wesson, a well-known gun manufacturer. And basically, they get a discount on those weapons because of what it kind of seems like a trade-in program, basically. Like you trade in your old cell phone, you get a discount on the new one, kind of the same thing. And what Smith & Wesson does is they turn those around and they sell those to other customers because the firearm, you know, there's a sort of a shelf life of that. The city, same with like vehicles and things like that, making sure that they're not keeping items for too long that are going to end up breaking down, that kind of thing. But they're not at the end of their life necessarily. So in order to end that program, which Mayor Aftab Puerville said at the urging of Cincinnati Police Chief Teresa Thiege, That the idea is they were really uncomfortable with those guns being sold and back out potentially on the streets of here in Cincinnati and their sort of efforts to reduce gun violence and reduce access to weapons. He talked about the fact that most of the guns that are committed in crimes were stolen from vehicles from other, you know, other locations. Basically that these are legal firearms, but they're being stolen by folks who have nefarious purposes. So in order to end that program, the city has to make up the difference between, you know, losing that discount from Smith & Wesson. And so that was this $500,000 in the carryover budget. It's not clear yet how many weapons that will cover, how long, you know, if this is a year's worth or if it's more than that. So it's something we'll have to look at a little more carefully moving forward. You know, probably we'll see this in the budget or just in the general police department budget in the future.
And you might have already said this, so my apologies if I'm asking you to repeat yourself, but if they're not going to return the firearms to Smith & Wesson, what's going to happen to
them? Yeah, I don't think I did say, but so they're going to destroy the weapons, basically. So instead of putting them back out into the market for resale through Smith & Wesson, when a firearm reaches the end of its life cycle, the city will destroy it and continue purchasing new firearms for officers.
Okay. So if I understand correctly, after everything that City Council has already approved, the city still has nearly $15 million in leftover money from last year's budget that council gets to decide how to spend, which sounds like kind of fun.
Yeah.
what are some of the possibilities? Is this a situation where different organizations are going to be coming to council and asking for money? Can you boost this here, give a grant there? What are some of the possibilities there?
There certainly will be a little bit of that. And that's the way that the carryover process, you know, used to work generally before the waterfall was established. And there was some sort of more direction on the front end from council for how administration should do this. It's a little bit more streamlined now. It's less of a kind of free for all, like people asking and trying to kind of competing with other organizations for this funding. But basically, each council member will have the opportunity, kind of like during the regular budget process, to put forward a motion of how they want to spend it. I know Councilmember Mark Jeffries, for example, would like to spend much of the carryover money on the Green Bank. That's another program, another thing I think has been discussed on this program. I expect we'll see some of the similar priorities like affordable housing. There may be the chance for some gap financing in there, probably some money put forward for pedestrian safety. One example in the mayor's recommendations that has already been approved is $500,000 for speed cushions on Coleraine Avenue. That's a program that there are always more requests than there is enough money to complete. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see some more pedestrian safety type focus projects in the carryover budget. But we'll see if there's consensus or not. Obviously, $15 million sounds like a lot of money, but it goes pretty quickly when each council member has their own priorities. And so we'll see how that all shakes out.
What's the time frame for this? What's next and when are you expecting some of these decisions to be made?
Yeah, I would expect the first look at what council might want to do with this. Not next week, likely the week after. There is no budget and finance meeting next week just because there's not a chair to chair the committee right now with some of the turnover. But then I would say 2 to 3 weeks is when we can expect council to make those decisions and actually vote on that.
Okay. Well, it's always great to follow your reporting. Everyone should keep doing that on our air and on our website, wvxu.org. I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter, Becca Costello. Thanks so much for your time today, Becca.
Thanks, Lucy.
And before we get to the next portion of our show, I want to let everybody know, coming up next Thursday, we're going to have a full hour on the presidential race, the issues, and what's important to the youngest voters this election. We'll be live from WCET's studio with a student audience hearing their perspectives ahead of election days. Election day. There's only one, thank goodness. Tune in Thursday, live at noon. You won't want to miss it. Up next, we'll talk about Cincinnati Public Schools' next phase of reorganizing some schools. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati Public Schools is working on a second phase of district reorganization after shifting several schools around before the start of this academic year. Joining me now to talk about that and other important news from the past week are WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Welcome back, Zach.
Good to be here, Lucy.
And WVXU environment reporter Isabel Nisley. Thanks for being here, Isabel.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Cincinnati Public Schools is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Zach, we talked during the summer about the Cincinnati Public Schools plan to reorganize several schools. Remind us what that plan entailed. And I'm glad you can explain it because it's very complicated in my head.
Yeah. So some people will remember phase one, which was done for a couple reasons. Basically, certain schools were looking for some more space, particularly in phase one, Spencer Center for Gifted and Exceptional Students. They were in a building that was kind of too small for them. They wanted to expand their enrollment. So basically what the district did was they moved them into Riverview East Academy. It's a larger building, larger school. But basically what that meant was the students there, the younger students, kind of elementary age, were moved to Mount Washington School, and the high school students there were sent to the second floor. So basically Riverview East right now, it's two schools in one. It's Spencer Center on the first floor. It's Riverview East Academy on the second floor. Now, those Riverview East students will eventually be moved out of there, and they'll be sent to different schools for the start of next fall in 2025. And then Spencer Center is going to take that over. Now, they also created a new middle school from Schroeder High School. So they took the 7th and 8th graders there, moved them into the Dr. Odell Owens building, which was formerly the Lighthouse building, because they renamed it this past year as well. So they created the district's only middle school. And so basically that is some of the pieces of phase one. And then phase two is going to be kind of similar to that.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about phase two in a minute. But first, how do the school's principals who were involved in phase one of all this, how do they say the school year is going so far?
Well, the last time they spoke about it was a couple months ago and basically said, you know, so far, so good. Of course, for a school like Riverview East Academy, where you're not really going to be around after the end of this year, it's tough. It's emotional. And certainly it's going to be a little bit hard for those students who are now going to have to find different schools to go to within Cincinnati Public Schools. But generally, they're saying, you know, it's well received and certainly for the principals of a school like Spencer Center that's getting kind of what they want out of this, it's going very well. So, so far, so good, according to some of the principals and according to, you know, Shauna Murphy, the interim superintendent. But of course, when this was rolled out right before the start of the school year, I mean, really, all this happened like a month before school started. And certainly that kind of move caused some tension, caused a little bit of dissatisfaction with some people because it was so short notice.
Right. Well, and you referenced this a little bit, but I want to make sure I understand. What were the key reasons behind these reorganizations? Some schools needed more room, other schools needed less. Does this save money in some way? Is that part of this?
Part of it, yeah, is it saves money, and it is described as a better utilization of school buildings. So if you look at kind of the population of CPS schools, you know, some of the elementary schools are below capacity. They have some extra space. But you look at a lot of the high schools, for example, Aiken High School, they have, I believe they're 300 students over capacity of typically what they would normally have. So they're really looking to kind of shuffle that around a bit. So maybe taking some students from elementary school buildings, moving them into a building with an existing elementary school that has space for them, and then using that building as a middle school where the students that are at the overpopulated high school can go there. So it's not really building anything new, but it's just kind of shifting things around so buildings have more space and the buildings that actually have extra space are filling those up.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Now, the district is talking about phase two of this reorganization, as you mentioned. What do we know so far about what that could entail?
Well, not a whole lot, but of course, somehow there's still more things to talk about. but these are kind of the early stages of this. So what we know about phase two is they're aiming to implement this by the start of next school year, fall 2025. And it's going to look a little bit like phase one, but there's going to be a focus on creating more of those middle schools. So Shauna Murphy has been big about creating middle schools within CPS. She says she likes what's that's happening with Schroeder Middle School right now. She wants to see that in different parts of the district. One, for space reasons, but also to improve educational environment, certainly for middle school students, seventh and eighth graders. Going into a big building, a high school like that can be a bit intimidating and maybe not the best environment for kind of focusing it on certain things. So that's kind of been the goal of Shauna Murphy, and that is a big part of phase two. But what it also does is it'll create some more welcome centers. So right now, Cincinnati Public Schools has one welcome center, and these are, and that what that is basically an initial place for students who are learning English can go to. And that's basically connecting them to the right school for them and connecting them to those kind of coordinators and people who can actually help them learn. So what they want to do is they want to put that in Hartwell School, Roberts Academy, and Dater High School. Those are kind of the areas where they're looking at where there are some more English language learners, and they want to put those resources right there in the school so they're not necessarily coming to the central office. And the reason why they're doing that is because they have more English language learners, and that population is continuing to grow. Mm.
That middle school piece, the superintendent was, interim superintendent was on our program before the start of the school year talking about that and how important that is to her. And I know I remember middle school as being a very difficult time. I don't know what the two of you remember, but okay, you referenced this. There was criticism that the first phase of this work happened quickly, like a month before the start of the new school year. And some people complained that they didn't have enough input from the community, that CPS officials were doing this without that input. What's the plan for this second phase? Is that really being taken into account?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a reason why they're starting this right now in fall of 2024 for fall of 2025. You know, that the biggest criticism about that first phase was people weren't given enough notice, and there really wasn't a ton of public input on this. So what they're doing now is they're putting out these initial ideas, some of their initial goals for next year, and they'll be hosting meetings throughout this month, talking to parents, talking to kind of school governing committees, and getting their thoughts on it and seeing like where can things be moved around so people aren't feeling like they're being left out. Kareem Moffitt, one of the school board members, she said, you know, being on board with something is a lot different than agreeing with it. And I think a lot of people felt that, you know, hey, people were on board with phase one, but they didn't really have much of a choice, much of a say in it. They want to give people more of a say, more of a choice, so they can develop something that is going to be maybe a little bit less hectic and receive probably less criticism there.
And school board members, you said, are the school board members on board with starting to implement this over the next school year? Or what? Remind us of what the time frame for phase two is.
So phase two, you know, they'll have a community input process, and then they'll kind of develop more of a larger plan. So it seems like they're on board with some sort of phase two. I think they recognize that things do need to be reorganized, and you know, schools do need to kind of balance their capacity, balance their enrollment. So they are definitely on board with some sort of phase two, but depending on what that looks like, you know, it'll depend if they're on board with kind of what's presented finally. And we probably will have an idea about that sometime in November. So we'll look for kind of more clear plans on that. But right now, the engagement process, and then kind of one of the big things here is making sure that this kind of thing is cost neutral. So they have some renovation plans possibly in mind, but really those are going to be kind of minor because they're really not looking to kind of build too much new and spend a lot of money.
You mentioned community engagement. Your story on our website, wvxu.org, has times and locations for different community feedback sessions. I think there are still 4 left that people can attend as of today. We're talking on October 11th, and there are still 4 left people can attend. Which neighborhoods do those cover?
So the next one coming up is a virtual one, actually, for Western Hills. So that is for their governing committee. After that, on October 22nd, they'll be doing one in South Avondale for that governing committee. And then also on the 22nd of this month, there's one for College Hill parents. And then on the 24th, there'll be one for Hughes High School and the parents there. So there's a couple more left for those specific groups and the parents at those schools. So that's kind of indicating which schools and which areas are going to be affected by this. And then after that, they'll start developing plans, and then they'll share that information later.
Yeah. And people can find details about those community feedback sessions in your story on our website, WVXU.org.
Yes.
Okay, Isabel, let's shift to higher education. You talked with a professor at the University of Cincinnati about petrochemicals like the styrene that leaked from a train car in Whitewater Township late last month. Tell us about this professor and what she had to say about whether we should be expecting more incidents like this.
Yeah, absolutely. So I talked to Dr. Amy Townsend Small. She's a professor of environmental science at the University of Cincinnati, and she really focuses in on oil and gas in her research. And after talking to her, the kind of main takeaway was we should be expecting more petrochemical leaks like this. And she says it has to do a lot with the oil and gas industry.
Okay. Tell us more about styrene. What's it used for? How toxic can it be?
Yeah, styrene is a chemical. It's derived from oil, like crude oil. And Dr. Townsend Small said it's a precursor for styrofoam. It's used to make plastics. And in Cincinnati, it's processed very close to the city at the INEOS plastics manufacturing plant. And in terms of toxicity, it evaporates into the atmosphere very quickly when it's gaseous. So in terms of the recent styrene leak, officials are still saying community's safe after that. But again, it's made from crude oil, so it's not really great for humans to be exposed to.
Yeah. And if I'm remembering, didn't people say they kind of got headaches, didn't feel great if they were smelling it, that kind of thing when there was that exposure?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so are there more of these chemicals like styrene being produced in the U.S.? And is this related to the country's increase in oil and gas production?
100%. Dr. Townsend Small kind of laid it out like this. She talked about the production of oil and gas that are used to make chemicals like styrene or like vinyl chloride, things like that. They're on the rise. In fact, last year, the U.S. produced more crude oil than any country has ever produced.
Any country?
Yes.
Like even Saudi Arabia.
Yes.
Places we, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And as oil and gas companies are producing more and more, they're not really wanting to build underground pipelines to transport it. So they're turning to plastics. They know that oil and gas can be used as precursors to plastics. And Dr. Townsend Small says, as a result, there's more of these chemicals traveling on trains to places in eastern Ohio and even along the Ohio River.
So that they're going to these manufacturing plants that want the raw materials to make these plastics.
Yeah.
What can be done to prevent spills like this in the future? If there are more of these chemicals traveling on trains, tanker cars, all kinds of things, and I'm sure people in Whitewater Township are thinking, we don't want this to happen again. What can be done to prevent these kinds of things?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that question is top of mind for many Whitewater Township residents. I went out to a community meeting last week, and many people had that question. And one thing that stuck out to me, the Central Railroad of Indiana, they had representatives there, and they said that by this common carrier law, they're required to transport all sorts of materials, whether they're hazardous or not. So one thing that could be done is just increased regulation of the railroad industry. I know after the chemical spill in East Palestine last year, I believe Congress introduced a new bill, but I don't think it has passed yet.
Hmm. Well, I thought this report was really interesting. And Isabel, I'm going to throw a curveball at you now a little bit, because you have this new beat for WVXU, the environment beat. You have been creating it. You've been doing, you know, harder edge news like this about styrene, but you also get to do things about like Take a Walk in the Park Day, which is delightful. Talk to us about how you're creating this beat and what kinds of stories you're trying to bring to light for people about the environment for our audience.
Really great question. And it's something that I'm still figuring out. I think I've been here for 4 months or so, but a lot
oh,
of
come
it...
on, you've got it all figured out.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say, actually. No, a lot of it really just has been listening and observing what's going on in the environment.
I know climate change has been a focus for you. I mean, that's got to be, is that kind of a driving force that you're following and stories related to that?
Certainly. I think every single story I've told can be connected to climate change, including this one about the increased likelihood of, or the likelihood for more styrene leaks or petrochemical leaks to occur, because we know that oil and gas, fossil fuels are primary drivers of the climate crisis. But I'm also trying to look into things like recreation and how we can appreciate our outdoors, like on National Walk to a Park Day, things like that. So just really delving into the environment as a whole and recognizing that we're all connected to it. Everything's connected, things like that.
Yeah. You have, this is a little bit of behind the curtain or how the sausage gets made or something like that, but you have a weekly call with other environment reporters who work at NPR stations. Is that right? Talk about, we don't want you to give away any secrets, but how does that help you in terms of crafting ideas and figuring out what you want to report on in this beat?
Yeah, absolutely. It's incredibly helpful to talk to other environment reporters. And like I was saying earlier, you know, everything is connected. So the other week, one of the environment reporters was talking about spotted lantern flies up near Cleveland. And that was like, oh my gosh, Hamilton County is also, you know, a quarantined area. So we were kind of able to talk about what's happening in both of these places, what's similar, and kind of compare our findings like that. And very helpful collaboration, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. How have you been getting much feedback from our listeners about like the stories you're doing? Or, I mean, I'm not, sometimes they only give you feedback to complain, I can say from experience. So don't worry if you're not, but I'm wondering, are you hearing from people about the kinds of stories you're doing?
Yeah. I got a very nice postcard from a listener that was a highlight. And just kind of chit-chatting, a lot of my friends' parents say they hear me, so.
That's good. That's good. And they would, I'm sure they would let you know if they had problems. Yeah. Well, I think you're doing a great job. We're all glad that you're here and part of the team.
Thank you, Lucy.
I've been talking with WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion and WVXU environment reporter Isabel Nisley. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to remind you again that we have this live politics show next Thursday on October 17th. It's a full hour on the presidential race, the issues, and what's important to the youngest voters this election. We'll be live from WCET's studio with a student audience. We'll be hearing their perspectives ahead of Election Day. Tune in Thursday, October 17th, live at noon. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great weekend.